before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on the oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Dean Huckabee versus Time Warner Entertainment Company and Fort Worth Independent School District versus City of Fort Worth and Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument, and the petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are taping these, the clerk's office is taping these arguments, and you may purchase a copy of the tape if you desire to do so by making application with the clerk for a nominal fee. Justice Owen is not participating in the first cause, but she will be here to participate in the deliberations and decisions of the second cause. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Huckabee versus Time Warner.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Pizzetti will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. This is Paul Franzetti representing Dean Huckabee. And this case involves defamation of Dean Huckabee in a film broadcast by HBO entitled Women on Trial. The film purports to be a documentary that tells a shocking but true story that despite overwhelming evidence and uncontroverted evidence that a five-year-old boy had been sexually abused by his father, Dean Huckabee ignored his duty as a judge to protect the best interests of that child and awarded custody to the abusive father and took that child out of his protective mother's home. The film also told that Judge Huckabee routinely made such decisions and left the indelible impression that as a result, Judge Huckabee must be corrupt. The story, however, was not true. The truth was that the boy had suffered an injury to his penis that was not done by the father during his custody. The evidence, which was known to HBO prior to the presentation of that broadcast, showed that the child was injured in his mother's house at the hands of his brother, who was nearly six years old. Judge Huckabee made the only...
You think that this court can find what you just said is to be true as a matter of law?
No, Your Honor, it is what the...
That's another version.
It's not exactly another version, Your Honor. It's what the evidence shows, and all inferences on summary judgment are to be drawn in favor of the non-movement, which is Dean Huckabee's position in this court.
That's true, even in a summary judgment and defamation case?
Yes, Your Honor, because there is no other... There may be conflicting evidence what was known, or... Well, first of all, there is no conflicting evidence as to what was known to HBO. They had knowledge, actual knowledge, of the fact that there was evidence showing that the brother had injured the child in the mother's home.
Who's they at HBO that had this knowledge?
Virginia Cox and Lee Grant, who were checking for the accuracy of this, of these details.
They were independent film producers, were they not?
HBO was relying upon them for the accuracy, or it says they were relying on them for the accuracy of this film.
HBO, anything that they know is imputed to HBO for liability purposes?
I wouldn't say that everything is, but in this case, this is a central and core, these are central and core points. They have been charged with getting the accuracy of this story right.
Well, HBO published this.
That's correct.
So HBO has its own duty check the accuracy of what it publishes, doesn't it?
And indeed, they spent 6 months in legal review on the very point.
They spent more time talking to their lawyers about whether it'd be liable than checking out the truth of the statements. Okay.
Much of this story is reporting one side's position in the case. That's okay, then.
If they said that's what they were doing, but that's not what the film said. The film says these are the facts. The film never says there's another side to the story. The film never says we're presenting the mother's side. The film only says this is what is going on. It starts out We are bringing you stories of medieval justice, irrational decisions. Irrational decisions. They're not saying there's two sides to this.
Judge Huckabee's on the film. Can you explain? First child is brain, the child in the first vignette is brainwashed, and they draw a conclusion. Why is that defamation?
They didn't go back and look at any. I'm sorry. Once they found that there were other versions of this story, initially they had submitted to HBO, the film company had submitted to HBO, a pitch piece that said corrupt judge awards custody to an abusing father to please his crony friends. Then they went out and started doing research. They had not done the research up till then. They had third-hand hearsay up to that point in time. And what is in the film is really no better than that. When they found evidence that, in fact, the abuse didn't occur at the hands of the father, but at the hands of the brother, and there's evidence of that, they didn't go out and try to interview the witnesses who testified to that, other witnesses other than Dr. Harrison. They didn't go out and try to interview the lawyers for the father.
Let me ask you, what if they had done that? What if they had gone out and interviewed the father and the witnesses and made the decision not to publish that? For some reason, they thought it was not trustworthy. Where do you draw the line on editorial choice for deciding what to actually put into the documentary?
Well, editorial choice doesn't allow a publisher to defame a judge or anyone. There's never been a case that says
but it,
that.
But it allows them to investigate, and if they don't believe something to be trustworthy, then it gives them some discretion as to whether to include it in the piece, right?
They can include it, but they can't say this is the fact. And that's the way this film starts out. These are the facts. These are irrational decisions.
Back to my question. What if they had interviewed the father and decided that because of other things they found out, they did not believe that his statements were credible? Then would you say that would be within editorial choice?
No, I think that they have to either say this is what we found, or they can't come out and say these decisions are irrational. They have to, because another thing they said in this.
So you're saying they would have to publish the father's story?
No, I didn't really say that. And what I'm saying is they could even just say we're presenting this story from the woman's side. We're presenting this story from the mother's side. They didn't say anything. They said these are irrational decisions. There is no other conclusion that could be drawn from these facts.
You don't think that's an opinion?
Not irrational.
Irrational and medieval are facts.
Well, medieval is different. Medieval probably is an opinion, but irrational is not an opinion. Irrational means there's no reason basis for that decision. And a judge sitting judging a case had two different versions of this story.
Well, there's a difference in a documentary on the conclusion being demonstrated as an opinion and what is ostensibly being demonstrated as the facts upon which the opinion is being made. So the distinction is not an opinion. The distinction is what do they represent to be the facts that lead to their opinion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in this case, your position is that they specifically excluded the facts that are material to forming that opinion, leaving the viewer to one only inescapable conclusion.
Well, not only do they leave the viewer to that conclusion, they say there's only. That's the message. There is no other conclusion in this case.
Mr. Franzetti, in a defamation case in state court in Texas, what must a plaintiff do to avoid a summary judgment when the defendant moves on the grounds that there is an absence of proof of actual malice?
Well, first the defendant comes forward with an affidavit saying, I did everything right.
Presuming that's happened, what must a plaintiff do to avoid a summary judgment?
And then a plaintiff must come forward with evidence showing that there was actual malice. And actual malice has...
To what level? Must they just show that a fact issue exists, or must they offer clear and convincing evidence?
This court in Castle v. Brand and Carr v. Brasher said specifically that they need not offer clear and convincing evidence at that stage. Because there are several reasons for that. Clear and convincing evidence is really, in Texas procedure, an admonition to the trial judge to review the evidence after the jury has found
the fact. Is that true in a defamation case where there's a constitutional component?
I believe that's an issue of Texas procedure. And the judge is charged with looking at the evidence and making sure that any jury verdict has been found on clear and convincing evidence. That is the constitutional duty.
You have to show clear and convincing evidence to get a judgment.
Ultimately.
Why shouldn't you have to do it if it's policy-wise, besides Casso, why shouldn't you have to do it at the summary judgment stage?
Well, for one thing, in this
case, you're not going to be able to win. Why not know it at the summary judgment stage?
Well, for one thing, in this case came long before there were no evidence summary judgment motions, but or to say that you have to produce clear and convincing evidence at the summary judgment stage strips away the protection that a non-movement has of having the inferences drawn in his favor.
The other side says it strips away their First Amendment rights, don't they?
This court has decided that that does not strip away their First Amendment rights. That is an issue of Texas procedure, and the other way is the issue of federal procedure.
Should this court reconsider its position in CASA?
No. I don't see anything in CASA that needs to be reconsidered.
How about in light of the new Texas no evidence summary judgment procedure?
Well, again, this case didn't arise under that. But that's an issue that,
assuming
that,
it did.
That is different.
Assuming it did.
Well, that's what the amicus is arguing for in this case.
I'm giving you the opportunity to answer their question.
Well, okay. As far as the clear and convincing evidence standard on this case is concerned, that is stripping away the rights that the plaintiff has of having the inferences drawn in his favor on the summary judgment stage. And this court has said that we are not giving a special procedure to the defamation defendants. And I don't think that is stripped away from defamation or from regular defendants in regular summary judgment proceedings on a no evidence summary judgment motion. You still have the inferences drawn in your favor.
On this record, did the plaintiff raise a fact issue, or is there any way this record can be interpreted, in your opinion, to rise to the level of presenting clear and convincing controverting proof?
I think it doesn't matter what standard you judge this case on. I think it is clear and convincing evidence because what we have in this case, the HBO folks, when they did their research, primarily videotaped everything they did. There is not a question as to what they knew and when they knew it and what they left on the cutting room floor and what they chose not to show to the public.
And what evidence do you rely upon as your controverting proof on actual malice?
First of all, the storyline says that women routinely lose custody of their children to the abusing father when they allege child abuse. They knew that was false because, again, they had interviewed, the only evidence they have on this, the only facts that they found on this was that Judge Huckabee's interview where he said this had happened four times in thousands of cases over 12 years. They didn't interview any other lawyers involved in this case other than the mother's lawyers. They didn't interview any other judges. They didn't go to the court records to see how routine this was. They just made the bald-faced statement, this is routine.
To put a very fine point on it, though, it says custody, not access, and the story's talking about access.
That is a fine point, Your Honor, but they would like to dumb it down to that, but they've been talking about access to a child. They said all access has been cut off. And then to say that in a broadcast where that flips by very quickly, to say that the ordinary viewer is going to see the difference between losing custody and losing access is a fine point.
Well, talking about the ordinary viewer, there's two vignettes about Judge Huckabee in here. And you talked quite a bit about the first one, but not about the second one. These remarks about routinely, ordinarily, cases from one courthouse, mean, they're very quick as compared to a long 12 or 15 minute segment about a case. And at least in the second case, you don't seem to question any of the essential facts that are presented by the documentary as to that story. Don't we have a substantial truth issue here? That is the overall gravamen of the story. And the part that is true and not controverted may leave a worse impression in the viewer's mind than a segment that you may have more question about, or one sentence or a voiceover that you may have an attack on. And if that's the case, aren't there doctrines of substantial truth that would give you trouble ever meeting the constitutional standard in an ultimate proceeding?
There is not substantial truth on that one either, Your Honor. It's just the actual defamatory statements were made in connection with the Hebert case. The Roberts and Rashke case form part of the theme that Judge Huckabee is a corrupt judge. That is not substantial truth. And there's no way that this court could find, or that I shouldn't say there's no way. That is not what the evidence said.
There was a lengthy explanation by one of the interviewees about what they meant by corrupt, which was not one meaning of corrupt, that is, you receive a payment of X number of dollars in exchange for a predetermined result, but it was corrupt in terms of judges maybe trusting the evidence that was presented by one lawyer more than the evidence presented by other lawyers, and having friends and so on and so forth, that they tended to look favorably on their presentations and thought this attorney put his life to them, I think is the words that was said.
Your Honor, the words said during the film are, they have a financial interest in protecting the system because they're making money off these appointments. These are words that are used. And you're right, they also go off on the other idea, but they talk about financial interest and they say, what other reason can there be? These decisions are so irrational. What other basis can there be but corruption?
And finally, I'm trying to phrase the question right, and I'll work on it before you come back up. But I want to explore more about how much Colts and Grant knew and how much the producers at HBO knew and what law you have that says that Colts and Grant's knowledge can be imputed to HBO. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Julie A. Ford will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Judge Huckabee had to come up with proof that HBO knew the film was false, or that it in fact had actual serious doubt about the truth of the film.
How much proof?
There was purposeful avoidance of the truth.
Your Honor, the theory of purposeful avoidance is a way to prove the serious doubt. It's not a third category.
Okay. And what about the fact that the father was not interviewed? Don't you think that's pretty substantial?
First of all, Your Honor, they tried to interview the father, and they negotiated with him for a while, and he finally backed out.
Is that in the summary judgment proof?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. There's no question that they tried to interview both fathers.
Part of Huckabee's position is that, as I understand it, this is a trial of the case for which there was testimony on both sides upon which the judge makes a decision.
That's right, Your Honor.
This is not a situation where somebody made some sort of public pronouncement and there's a question raised about how ridiculous that announcement was, and this was somebody's opinion. This was a position that a judge made a decision on custody and access, and that the implication was this was the story before the judge on which the judge's decision was made. is it not something to be factored in this mix on avoidance of the truth and what was known? Not only, well, the failure to look at the record before the trial court, or having looked at the record before the trial court, the choice of not presenting that record. In other words, not interviewing witnesses, but in fact not presenting the record that was before the trial court, but only the statement of the mother. Could that not rise to the level of avoidance of the truth in the context of this demonstrating the judge's decision is faulty?
Your Honor, I have two answers to that question. One, on the facts of this case, to clarify what the facts were, and second, on what the law is. The facts of the case are that, contrary to what Judge Huckabee has tried to suggest, this evidence that a court-appointed psychologist came up with an opinion that someone other than the father had abused the boy, this had absolutely nothing to do with Judge Huckabee's decision to take the child from his mother. Nothing. It's Kit Harrison's opinion. He wasn't even appointed to the case until 2 months after Judge Huckabee had taken the boy away. Didn't reach his opinion until 5 months later. Now, what the filmmakers did is...
Now, the position they take is this was the record before the judge in making the decision, and you're saying that was not true.
Absolutely wrong. It is not there. What was before the judge is uncontested. It's in the evidence. It's the pleading and the transcript of this hearing that took place in March 1988. And it's uncontested that the filmmakers did read that transcript, talked to the lawyers that were involved in the case. And the transcript's in the evidence, by the way. And there is no evidence that the brother did it. At best, what you have at the end of the hearing is the father's lawyer is arguing that it was anybody but his client. And so he suggests in argument only that, well, let's see, the little boy screamed and cried when he got home. So that must have been when the injury happened, which is contrary to what the doctor's testimony was. The injury could have happened while the child was with the father or while the child was home with his mother. So we don't know. But in any event, Mike Hebert's lawyer says, could have been Sandy, the mother, that did it. Could have been John, the brother. Or little Wayne could have done it to himself in a fit of rage that night. And that is all there is in the record to show about who done it. And that's all that was before Judge Huckabee at the time he made his decision. Now, and the filmmakers knew that. And the filmmakers, when you watch the film, if you watch it again, you'll see they talk about what the evidence before Judge Huckabee was. And see, the problem here is that Judge Huckabee wants HBO to be legally required to say that Kit Harrison thought, Kit Harrison's opinion, and it was only Kit Harrison, he thought that Wayne had been sexually abused by his 12-year-old brother, John. And this argument doesn't make any sense, first of all, because it had nothing to do with Judge Huckabee's decision. This was something that happened months after the decision. And when you look at the film, you'll see why this doesn't make any sense. The film shows Sandy's lawyer saying, Judge Huckabee thinks this is the most classic case of brainwashing he's ever seen. And then the film shows Judge Huckabee describing the reasons for his ruling. And he says in the film, I have to do what I think is best for the child. In my opinion, if someone's brainwashing a child, especially coupled with some physical abuse, the child has to be removed from that situation. And he later says if a person's sexually abusing a child, they're probably going to have to seek mental health care. And at this point, the viewer has been told that Judge Huckabee thinks Sandy or someone else other than the father had either physically or sexually abused the boy, and Judge Huckabee thought he needed to take Wayne away from that situation, which is exactly, of course, what Judge Huckabee says the truth is.
Counsel, did you move for summary judgment and support it with summary judgment on any grounds other than lack of actual malice?
Your Honor, Ashley Mouse was our last grounds for summary judgment.
But on the other, I mean, there's a bunch of grounds in there, but is it, are the other allegations supported by truth, substantial truth, opinion? Are they supported by enough evidence in the summary judgment record to sustain a summary, the Court of Appeals decision?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The evidence was uncontested. What the record has in it is that all of the factual descriptions of what happened in court, the pleadings, the allegations, the summary of the evidence, all of that is true or substantially true. That was the first grounds we moved on. It was only later after discovery we came back and did actual malice as well.
But this was a broad form summary judgment order in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we were to agree with the petitioner in this case, this is a remand of the Court of Appeals to consider your other grounds for summary judgment on appeal. Is that correct?
That is one option, Your Honor. However, everything is before this court. The entire record is before the court. There is no reason why this court, if it wanted to look at the factual issues to decide whether or not the facts in the film were true, it certainly should do that before this court, and Judge Huckabee invited this court to look at the other grounds.
Does it matter in this case what standard of proof we hold the petitioner to in controverting your proof of the absence of actual malice?
In this case, Your Honor, it doesn't matter at all. The court
didn't even raise the fact issue.
The Court of Appeals properly found that there was no proof of actual malice. It did articulate a standard, the same standard that's followed by the Dallas Court of Appeals, by the San Antonio Court of Appeals, Houston First District Court of Appeals, which is they said the plaintiff needed to come up with specific affirmative proof. But then it turned around and said there was no proof.
Give me an example of specific affirmative proof of malice.
That would work?
Right.
Fabrication has been quite successful. If there is evidence that the defendant simply made up a story, that has been held. There's a case out of San Antonio where
What about avoidance of factual matters?
Purposeful avoidance of the truth is built into the analysis of whether the defendant had actual serious doubts about the truth. And the Supreme Court case where they said that this could be circumstantial evidence of actual doubt. And in that case, what had happened, of course, is that the evidence was you had a big important difference here, you had a false statement of fact about the plaintiff in that case, and then you had evidence that the newspaper checked into other sources, but there were two sources where they absolutely could have checked and verified that this was true, and they didn't. They relied solely on one unreliable witness, and the tape of the critical conversation that the witness was describing was handed to the newspaper.
So what you're saying then, based upon your test, when any media outlet reports on a lawsuit, which inherently has at least two sides, if the outlet ignores one side and reports only the other side to the detriment of some party, that would be sufficient to establish malice?
No, Your Honor. Here's the problem. When the media reports on a lawsuit, on a trial, they are privileged to repeat the bad things that the two parties were saying about each other. And under the common law, you couldn't do that. They can say this horrible evidence and this horrible evidence, and that goes to protect them from liability against the litigants themselves. When it comes to criticizing a judge, and the judges are government, and what a judge did, there is no obligation to come up with one side or the other.
But this isn't about whether Judge Huckabee got it wrong or not. This is about whether he's corrupt. This film is a non-story if they just said, well, one more judge got the wrong decision. So, and that happens all the time. But the point of this is, there is something terrible going on here, and people are getting it wrong for bad, evil reasons. Isn't that the point of the film?
The main point of the film is that the judges are getting it wrong because they're overreacting to allegations of abuse in custody proceedings.
Well, what does contributions to the judge have to do with that?
Nothing.
Well, then why is that in the film?
It is in the film with the second segment that has nothing to do with Judge Huckabee. And it was absolutely a huge ongoing controversy in Houston. That everything you hear about the corruption and the contributions influencing judges, that's all in the record. The Houston Chronicle has been running stories for months and months about this.
They don't say corrupt, strangely.
Your Honor, the stories in the Houston Chronicle say that the family law courts are rife with tales of cronyism, corruption, and bias, and that it's particularly in the area of custody abuse.
Says fraught with tales of cronyism, of financial and sexual inequities, and of attorneys who feel pressure to contribute to judges' campaigns.
Yes, Your Honor.
You think that translates into corruption?
Your Honor, the film doesn't translate into corruption.
The film doesn't?
No, Your Honor. There is nothing in the film, nothing that suggests corruption.
They use that word.
Your Honor, they do not. That word, corrupt or corruption, is not in the film.
Then what was the person who was interviewed said they're corrupt and then explained what they meant by that?
I don't think the word corrupt was used.
I could be wrong about that.
Let me ask you this. The segment is Christy Myers saying, what's going on here? She says there are things going on that aren't in the evidence of the court. And again, it has nothing to do with Judge Huckabee. This is Judge Daggett's story. And it's all straight out of the press. Christy Myers from Channel 13 says, well, it's you know, because of the campaign contributions, it's not overt. It's just this judge knows the lawyer, and the lawyer says, trust me, my client's not going to do anything bad. And the judge goes, okay, I trust this guy. He's not going to do anything bad.
Going back to Justice Hex's question, the point of the story was not that the judge got the wrong decision. The point of the story is that the judge was corrupt.
Your Honor, I cannot think that how that could possibly be a reasonable interpretation of the film. That it
You're
says
serious.
Judge Huckabee is corrupt.
You're serious?
I'm absolutely serious, Your Honor.
Okay.
People should walk away from that film thinking he's the greatest guy in the world.
Absolutely not.
Just a little dumb.
The issue of corruption. I think the implication of the film is that Judge Huckabee made some very bad decisions, that he was far too harsh, unsympathetic to mothers, didn't listen to what the evidence, the little children were saying. All very general implications. But what the point of all of this is those implications are not false statements of fact. The Constitution says we have four constitutional protections. Each one of those are at work in this case. The first one, and they're all summarized in Milkovich versus Lorraine Journal at 497 U.S. 1. The first protection is that on matters of public concern, to be actionable, a statement has to be a provably false statement of fact. The Ninth Circuit
So in this film, if at the end of it, the producer had come back on and said, well, we've looked at this, and it is our conclusion that these judges are corrupt and are making decisions for illicit reasons. And that wouldn't be defamatory. You wouldn't have an actual malice problem there.
Those are two questions. Would the conclusion based on what was said in the film that we think these judges are corrupt, I don't think that would be an actionable statement. Because in the context of this film, remember, this is political speech. This is core First Amendment speech. We get to say, I know y'all don't like it, but we get to say, the courts are making bad rulings, and we don't like it, and we're very, very suspicious about why they're making those rulings. We get to say that. This is absolutely protected under the Constitution.
Let me get back to the purposeful avoidance of the truth.
Okay.
Question. Would you agree that if no effort had been made to interview the fathers, that would be some evidence of purposeful avoidance of the truth to avoid summary judgment?
No, Your Honor, because I have to follow up with evidence of purposeful avoidance of the truth gets to the question of what is the truth, which then asks the question, what is the false fact issue in the
law? We're talking about purposeful avoidance of the truth.
Right. And what is, and to answer your question, the truth has to be out there contrary to a published false statement.
Well,
how
do you know something's true or false if you haven't interviewed the father?
Because, Your Honor, the facts in the case were all in the record.
Okay,
they read the transcript.
So, even if there had been no effort whatsoever to interview the father, you would say that is no evidence of purposeful avoidance of the truth?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's what the film says that counts.
What about the cases that talk about failure to examine or talk to a witness who has knowledge that can be evidence? The San Antonio case, for example.
I'm not familiar.
I believe you referenced the San Antonio case where they did not go out and interview two people who would have had knowledge about the case that would have shed light on the truth of what was reported.
Those cases all involve situations where we're not talking about reporting on a court proceeding. Those cases all talk about Mary said this, Joe said this, out there in the world, whatever. What this film is talking about is what happened in a court. And we know what happened in court.
If it's a court proceeding, you're saying, how would you ever have purposeful avoidance of the truth if you have a court proceeding? Are you saying there just is no such thing? Can you pose a scenario where there could be purposeful avoidance of the truth in a court proceeding?
I'm having trouble coming up with an example, Your Honor, because what happened in the court is all objective evidence. If an order says the judge said that he was going to cut off the little boy's arm, and that's not what happened in court, you know, and they just heard this from one woman, and they didn't go back to look at the court records to see if that happened. Yes, that would be a case of purposeful avoidance.
What if you have a situation where plaintiff sues defendant, and media outlet presents all the facts favorable to the plaintiff? Very compelling story, presents no facts that came out of trial favorable to defendant, but yet the trial judge rendered take-nothing judgment in favor of the defendant. And after the end of a 30-minute presentation, the media outlet says there can only be one reason why the judge, what we believe there can be only one reason why the judge did this, and that's because the defense lawyer contributed to the judge's campaign. No problem.
If the fact that the defense lawyer contributed to the judge's campaign a true fact in your hypothesis, yes, that's not actionable.
Reminds me of the statement, it's accurate but not true.
Your Honor, and with here's the deal. With judges, that's the rule. And the Ninth Circuit put it beautifully in ABC versus Dodds. Judge Dodds was unhappy about a primetime broadcast. And he had a list of implied statements, very similar to the ones here, and the Ninth Circuit, those complaints have been dismissed by the trial court, the Ninth Circuit affirmed, and what they said was that when you're talking about this core political speech, because remember, we're not criticizing the man, Judge Huckabee, we are criticizing the governmental agent.
That's preposterous. For somebody to say that a judge is doing things for corrupt reasons is not slam at the judge individually.
But, Your Honor, corrupt is one thing. You have to make a specific allegation of corruption in that situation.
But to say Judge Huckabee is different from the person Huckabee when he's sitting up there in a robe and talking on the television cameras is just ludicrous.
Your Honor, the
we weren't really talking about the judge himself. We were just talking about whatever was sitting in a black robe. That's crazy.
That's the way it has to be, Your Honor.
Because
the judge is the government, and we have to... Citizens have to be able to criticize
government. I don't disagree with that. But you said it wasn't aimed at him individually, and it clearly was.
We didn't say anything about him being corrupt. All we did was criticize his two decisions. That's it. And to say that the film implies a statement of fact that Judge Huckabee, in fact, made these decisions because he had taken some kind of bribe. That's ludicrous. That is not a reasonable interpretation of this film. It can't be.
Your position has been that it really doesn't matter how we break down the legal. The legal requirements, particularly on behalf of the plaintiff in this case, that HBO can win on any grounds, but let's suppose that the court gets confused in some of the details, and it does start to matter. Would you discuss why you believe that to prevent a summary judgment, a public figure plaintiff must present a quantum of evidence that's greater than just some evidence. Why there has to be, why a trial judge should be given in this special case the power to go in and reweigh the evidence and say that the summary judgment should be sustained unless there's clear and convincing. And is that a constitutional requirement, or is that just a better policy, more efficient government?
First of all, in this case, it wouldn't matter which standard you
use. We know that you're...
But the amicus are urging that this court reconsider its findings and its decision to not follow Anderson v. Liberty Lobby.
And is that your position?
Your Honor, I think it would be a very good idea for this court to reconsider that, and here's why. The issue of actual malice is a constitutional issue. And the Court of Appeals, after a trial, will be evaluating the evidence, completely independent evaluation of the evidence to see if clear and convincing evidence was there.
Because it's a legal question, you agree it's a legal question.
I'm sorry?
Because it's a legal question, you agree it's a legal question constitutionally.
It is a legal question. It absolutely is. And as a practical matter, if it is clear before trial that the plaintiff cannot come up with what it takes to show that the defendant seriously doubted the truth, if they have no evidence that they can show that with.
Well, we're back to no evidence,
well,
which is CASO and a standard that Texas judges are familiar with. But I'm asking whether or not we, in the course of this opinion, if we get this far, we should look at whether or not it's constitutionally required that we put this greater burden on trial judges, and if it's not, would it still be better policy?
The United States Supreme Court has never said that it's constitutionally required for that particular level of review to happen at the summary judgment level.
Do you think it's constitutionally required that there be any summary judgment proceeding in a defamation case?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. It's never been presented to the U.S. Supreme Court. I certainly think it's a matter of Texas policy that not only should this be something resolved at summary judgment,
well, we didn't have summary judgments until 1950, and there have been judges on this court since then who thought we ought to repeal the summary judgment rule. And said so publicly. And my question is, would we be free agents to do that?
To decide that you absolutely can't do summary judgment.
There's no summary judgments.
I would be happy to take that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think I might win on it.
All right, well, if there's a constitutional issue there, then is there any constitutional issue beyond that you've said there's not? The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't spoken on that.
They've not spoken on that issue. This court has, however, and in fact, you did. And you were right. That in a sense...
Well, I got five votes for most of my
And that is, we have to be sensitive to the constitutional issue going on here, which is every single time a judge sues somebody and says, "You criticized me unfairly, I'm going to sue you," that is going to serve to muzzle the citizens' right to criticize judges' rulings. And that is a very important interest that has to be protected because, and then as a practical matter, if you can see down the line that the plaintiff is not going to meet their burden, why would you go through the trial, the trauma, the expense of the trial, especially when the balance of that is the chilling effect on free speech?
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you agree that judicial proceedings are entitled to this extra degree of protection?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, from what I understand, opposing counsel said that you cannot purposefully avoid the truth, but in a judicial proceeding, you can decide not to go interview people with knowledge. You can rely on the record. Do you agree with that assessment?
No, because what HBO is trying to do in this case is take statements of fact, statements that they have presented as fact in the case, not as opinion. they have said these decisions were irrational. If they're irrational, go find out whether there is no evidence on the other side. That's what they said. Whether these kinds of actions are routine.
I just don't see how irrational can be something other than opinion. Whether the sun is up or not is a fact. Whether you're not making any sense is a matter of opinion.
In some contexts, that's true. But what they said here was they interwove routinely loses custody, irrational decisions, and came to the conclusion of corrupt judge. Irrational does have a
separate meaning. The opposing counsel said it wasn't in the transcript. I spent 5 minutes of the argument looking for it. I can't find it.
The word corrupt does not appear in the transcript. However, they've got to be awfully bad filmmakers if that's not what they intended to say, because that was the whole intent from day one when this concept was purchased, was to show a corrupt judge handing custody to an abusive father and cutting off all access.
I agree that that's what the tape tries to convey, and the documentary is designed to convey that information. But it seems to me that if any of the discrete statements about the record for the trial court is correct, and they haven't left out any material piece of evidence upon which the judge had any other basis for deciding the case, then is the representation overall accurate, and leaving you only with the conclusion, if that's what was before the judge, when the judge made the decision, then they're free to decide the judge was irrational and say so.
If that were true in this case, I might have to agree with that. But that isn't true in this case. They didn't show the fact that the child had told the CPS worker, my mommy told me to give that other story the first time. They knew that. They didn't talk about the facts from the child to his mother saying, John did it. That wasn't in the film. There's no reference of anything like that. What they said is, what the message of the film is, there is no way. Abusive father and cutting off all access.
I agree that that's what the tape tries to convey, and the documentary is designed to convey that information. But it seems to me that if any of the discrete statements about the record for the trial court is correct, and they haven't left out any material piece of evidence upon which the judge had any other basis for deciding the case, then is the representation overall accurate, and leaving you only with the conclusion, if that's what was before the judge, when the judge made the decision, then they're free to decide the judge was irrational and say so.
If that were true in this case, I might have to agree with that. But that isn't true in this case. They didn't show the fact that the child had told the CPS worker, my mommy told me to give that other story the first time. They knew that. They didn't talk about the facts from the child to his mother saying, John did it. That wasn't in the film. There's no reference of anything like that. What they said is, what the message of the film is, there is no way anybody could have made an opposite decision. And it's the message of the film that counts. Every case has to look at what the gist or the message is being said in order to determine whether or not the message is defamatory.
I think they use the word pro-father in here someplace. Is that opinion or what's your view on that? Is that opinion or fact?
Pro-father is probably opinion. But again, opinion and fact, the distinction between that was taken away by the Supreme Court in Milkovich, and sometimes a statement of what appears to be opinion is really a statement of fact and can be defamatory.
I'm trying to get a handle on this. The for you to get where you want to go, there has to have been something in the record before the trial, or let me start over. If the documentary is based on a judge's decision, it seems to me that the only thing that would be relevant would be what was the record before the judge when the judge made that decision. Ms. Ford's response has been that everything they said about the record before the judge, upon which the judge based the decision, was true. Was true. You argue that the conclusion of rational is not true. But her point is, if everything we've said, the facts that we've said are true, she goes so far as to say, we don't have to say anything about the defendant's facts. If everything we say about the plaintiff's facts are true, then we're protected. You've argued there's an avoidance of the truth issue, which implicates there's other people you should have talked to and that sort of thing. Well, if it's a trial case, then it seems to me that means there's something in the record before the trial judge, before the judge made, that would have demonstrated that all these things being true actually were false. What in the trial record was intentionally avoided or recklessly avoided that would have demonstrated the plaintiff's record before the trial court was false? And you've said, you've identified the CPS statement that the mother told the child what to say. Is there anything else?
That's one issue. The other thing we have to remember in this case, this was presented as a documentary. This was not presented as an op-ed piece. This is what is going on in the world. That's what they said. And so it's not a report of the entire case. They made a report of the mother's version of this case. There was plenty of evidence to show brainwashing of the child. There was plenty of evidence at the hearing stage to show that the father did not do it, that the injury occurred outside
the hearing stage. They're arguing at the hearing stage, they said that was not before the court until 2 months after the judge had removed the child from the mother.
Is that wrong?
That
is wrong. That evidence was before the court at the time of the hearing. It just wasn't in the form. It just wasn't from Kit Harrison at that point. But that evidence was at the hearing in front of Judge.
Well, tell me, was it a written report? What was this thing that was before the trial court?
We have videotapes of the CPS workers interviewing Wayne. Two of those were viewed by Judge Huckabee, and he saw the one in which the child said, "My mommy told me to say it that."
No, I'm talking. I said that's the piece of evidence that you say was there. I said, was there any other piece of evidence that was before him? And I'm talking specifically about the comment that Harrison had identified that the abuser may have been the older brother who was living in the mother's home. She said that wasn't even there until after the decision.
That was there, Your Honor. It was there in the form of other testimony and other evidence in front of the court.
Do you agree that the movement presented summary judgment evidence, whole panoply of grounds they could get summary judgment on, that factually it was true, substantially true, opinion not fact, and actual malice as well. I mean, the whole case essentially before us as far as the grounds for the summary judgment.
Your Honor, what's been briefed in this court is just the actual malice.
Well, I know
we did have the
whole case in front of it.
Well, that's all the Court of Appeals rendered its verdict or rendered its decision. And, Your Honor, we did throw it to your hands to review the briefs below and in order to render a decision and even send this case back down to the trial court or render a decision in this court. However, do I think they prevail? Of course not.
No, I know that. I know you don't think that. Do they have a summary judgment record that presents all the grounds of their summary judgment to the appellate courts for review?
They purport to. They do not. Again, the trial judge denied this summary judgment.
But you believe you win on the merits, not on the fact that they failed to raise a point or some type of waiver or failed to back it up with an attempt at an affidavit.
Well, that's one of our points, that we do win on the merits. But again, the affidavits that were submitted, we say, didn't even raise the issue because they weren't free from inconsistency and otherwise credible.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.